adaptive behavioral therapy. And Sarah Denning is going to talk to us about what she knows about anxiety from her work with this thing that she calls the Anxiety Notebook Series. So I imagine we're going to learn a great deal today. Sarah, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, let's start off with a basic. What's new in our understanding about anxiety?
Wow. Well, we just had the decade of the brain. So neurology is now completely open and available so that we can see the mechanisms of anxiety. It's like lifting the hood on the car. And that means we know the mechanism, and if we can get in there and tinker around with it and teach people to be a good mechanic, then we know a lot about how anxiety is enacted.
All right, so what do we know?
We know that anxiety is learned as a behavioral response through our experiences in our developmental years, and that's age one day, right on, probably actually minus one day. There's a lot of work being done at Yale in neonatal development. There's a lot of work being done in adolescent development, why teenagers' brains literally are different. They're not myelinated, so it's like not having the plastic on the outside of the electrical wire. Half their brain is myelinated, half is not. Highly susceptible to anxiety. So we soak it up and we create adaptive responses. And my adaptive response might be, I get used to it, so I tolerate a problem. Or my adaptive response might be, I don't like it, so I back away from it. All depends on our environment. Environment, genes, and what's happening at the moment.
So when does anxiety become something that's, is it always undesirable?
No. We were just speaking earlier about anxiety possibly being a motivation. Lower levels of anxiety, nervousness, a little uncomfortable, a little distress, a little irritation, it might cause us to find a problem and act on it.
How about it even could lead to excitement, you know, like the jitters when you're going out with somebody for the first time and, or you're meeting somebody for the first time. All of that could be part of it.
Yes.
When is it a problem?
All of your listeners already know when it's a problem from their own physical experience of distress, whether it is uncomfortable, whether it's something that they then avoid and the problem persists, or it's something that they act on too much and that overreaction becomes a problem. So,
but Sarah, the problem seems to become, I don't know if people are aware of their anxiety, because people always say what they're nervous about. Now, you and I know that people get nervous and then they think, and then they think their nervousness is about whatever they're thinking.
Right.
So if a person has, if for one reason or another, has a high anxiety level, it's a natural response of the brain to say, hey, we're nervous, so there must be danger. Where's the danger? And so what a person does is they fetch for danger, and they look, oh, I'm worried about my daughter in Washington who hasn't called me in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Now, I would like that person to learn why they have the anxiety response to the level that they do and why it becomes a problem. That becomes more historic in experience. We learn our style of reaction in our developmental years, again, from the people around us, the places that we're in, the things we're exposed to. So I like people to learn, I'm anxious in this way, and that does or doesn't work well for me.
Okay, but also, I mean, do you agree that most things that people are anxious, what they think they're anxious about, is really the source of the anxiety?
I'd give it a 50-50.
Okay.
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. Even you and I, who are well-versed in this, and lots of other people who are very conscious and aware, and we have all this nice mindfulness going on, maybe we got it, maybe we didn't. Tricky business, anxiety.
So the best that you've got is, let me teach you about where, no matter where the source of it is, let me teach you to identify it, find it, and find a way to work with it to as to reduce it when it gets to a point where it's uncomfortable for you and the people around you.
Exactly. It sounds very simple. It's a little hard to do, but most people can actually do it pretty well.
Well, what's our history about trying to deal with this before now? What have we done in the past?
Well,
I mean, just medicate, right?
My own experience with being a therapist was my main motivation for coming up with something a little bit more pragmatic, a little more applied, a little more teachable right there with someone. Because I think we've had a lot of good concepts. Psychology is full of wonderful ideas and extrapolations and the maybe it works this way, maybe it works that way. But again, in the last 10 years, we've opened the black box. That doesn't mean it's all mechanical. There's a lot more going on there than brain functioning. But we really can see patterns. We can see how, just like the rest of our body, we carry our old reactions with us. We have scars from things that happened when we were six. If we're lucky, they're not very big scars anymore, but they're there. Our brain is very similar. So we know to look at past experience now.
All right. That's what we've known, but from the past.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. What I meant was, what were the treatments from the past? The different treatments that we had. We had psychotherapy. We thought that psychoanalysis would help you uncover the root of your anxieties based on the recreation of some early childhood kind of drama, trauma, or problem that's manifesting in a current situation, and that's causing your anxiety. That's one theory.
Exactly right. However, if therapists had talked to their patients just like that and created that recipe for that individual with them, I think they'd be on the right track. So a lot is correct in our historical treatment. I don't think it ever went far enough. And I think we chose its thinking, its feeling, its behaving, and we separated it out, which good scientists do. But I think we have to put it all back together again at some point. And that, I believe, is the next step beyond what everyone now sees as cognitive behavioral therapy, which is great. I'd like to add in some more behavior, teaching the patient right there at the moment so that we catch anxiety in action. The patient catches the anxiety between sessions and has something to do.
All right. So what we want to do is we're going to teach today ways of identifying your anxiety as it happens and then being able to find ways to moderate and lower it while it's happening, right? And this is what Dr. Sarah Denning does in her anxiety notebook series. So we have a number of things. You know, we have a lot of thoughts. We have a lot of habits that we do. How many different ways does anxiety manifest itself, Sarah? I mean, high anxiety.
Oh, gosh. Well, if we want to start at the top, let's start with a level 10, since we've got our stress scale we're going to introduce in a moment. Let's just use it. A 10 is a panic attack, and a 10 is, everybody who's had one knows, they really have lost complete control of their physiological reactions. They're fainting. They're falling down. They feel like they're having a heart attack. Their shortness of breath, their body is telling them, you are completely and totally stressed out, and I'm going to either knock you out or I'm going to make you get help right now. So that's a 10. Now, that's very physiological. Of course, the fear that goes with that is intense as well. Most people think they're dying. So they run to a hospital, which is what their body's telling them to do.
You know what happens with so many professionals, as I keep finding here in the air, you're so familiar with something that it's to you, it's almost, here's just what it is. Let me break it down for people a little better than that. How do you know when you're having a panic attack? When you could easily mistake it for a heart attack, you could mistake it for something physically wrong with you. You could say, you know, I've got an infection, I've got the flu. Mm-hmm. What are the symptoms, specific symptoms? And I'm going to ask you to slow it down because to you know it so well, you just run them off. But what is it that we could say to people? Here's what you look for, you know. Can you be able to turn to somebody and say, I'm having a panic attack? Now, I would be able to do that, and you would be able to do that, but many people wouldn't know the difference between that and a heart attack and a, you know. So how could we help them with this? What would we say to help people identify what a panic attack specifically feels like?
Well, let's work with a mechanism. When our body gives us a signal of some kind, our heart is beating so rapidly, we hear it in our ears, we can feel it in our throat, our breathing has changed, either deepened tremendously or it's very shallow. We're sweating. Our body is giving us every signal that something's wrong. I might think, oh my Lord, I've got food poisoning. I might think, I am having a heart attack, depending on, of course, my age, my sense of my body, what's normal. And now we have to do something which is teachable. And we have to ask the question, what is the level of stress in my life right now?
When you're having a panic attack, you can't ask that question.
Absolutely not. It's the most difficult thing to do. So it's very difficult to discern.
Okay, so you got me for a minute there. I ask myself, hey, did I get bit by a snake? Because I'm having all this stuff surge through my body, and I'm feeling real crazy right now, and I'm feeling like sweating, and I have sweaty palms. And I would walk into an emergency room, and they'd say, it's a panic attack.
No, they might not. No, they are also going to go through a series of questions with you. And that is how they, and hopefully you, will also discern what is going on.
Okay, so what would the questions be if I'm with someone who I care about who's having a panic attack and I want to discern, did they get bit by a snake or are they having a panic attack? What would the questions I would ask besides, did you get bit by a snake?
Well, that's the first question. If you're walking in the woods and you're out hiking upstate New York, and of course these kinds of things happen right then and there, and great question. The question might be, do you feel like you're faint? Can you breathe? These are important questions. It's the same questions we ask a choking victim. If the person says, no, I can't breathe, I don't care if they're having a panic attack. I'm getting on my cell phone and calling 911. If the person says, I feel like I'm going to faint, lose consciousness, I don't care if they're having a panic attack. I'm going to call 911. So let me change our question a little bit for our purposes here. If the person says, I feel very shaky right now, or I'm really scared. I seem to be really scared right now. Or they simply stop and they say, I don't know what's happening to me. Then I might ask them, did you get bit by a snake? But I also, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? Not what are you feeling? Because we do have the ability to know what we're thinking. In other words, I can ask you what you were thinking just a few minutes ago. You were thinking about the question that we were talking about. I can probably remember what I was thinking just before I walked in here. So we have that ability. It gets trickier the more physical it becomes. So again, if we use a stress scale and we catch our stress at much lower levels, now we have a chance to do what you are really asking. And I think it's a marvelous thing is, can I talk to this person right now in that way? Can this person talk to me in that way? Or do we simply need to get them to a hospital? So this is the upper range
stress. In my 35 years of doing a practice, I've never had a person walk into my office having a panic attack who had to go to a hospital instead. I have found instead that one of the things I look for is I always see hyperventilation. And when a person's always hyperventilating when they're having a panic attack, if I see the two of those going together, the person's hyperventilating and they seem like they're losing control, one of the first things I do is see if I could get them to breathe only through their nose, in and out through their nose, and that always will tell me whether it's controllable or not. 9 out of 10 cases it is when they start breathing through their nose instead of hyperventilating. Because I find most people having panic attacks are feeding the panic attack with hyperventilation.
Sure.
So, but they don't know that, you see. People don't know that. And so one of the questions I would ask our audience is, when you're in this place, is that person breathing in and out fast through their mouth? You know, do you see it? Do you see hyperventilation? Because in most of the cases where there's a panic attack, I will ask a person to be aware of their breathing. Just be aware of it and try to control it, not by holding their breath, which is not the right idea, but breathing exclusively in and out through your nose. When a person does that and can do that, you can't hyperventilate through your nose, you see. So it kind of brings them down. All right, so now I see that it's controllable and I realize the person is having a panic attack. Now, like you, my question is, this is something you suffer with. How do we learn to identify your levels so that it doesn't reach here again and again? Now, you have a questionnaire. You have things that you ask. You've developed a questionnaire in your workbook, which I believe is very helpful for people who suffer from great anxiety. What are the questions you would ask? What would be the question scale that helps people identify their stuff?
Well, it's actually not my questions for the person. It is the person identifying a level 5, which is a healthy coping level of stress. Now, that sounds high, maybe, for some people, a 5. But a 5 is right between 1 and 10. So I interview that person as to when they have felt stressed, but that they were coping. They had a way to identify what was going on. They were doing something about it. In other words, their anxiety was serving a purpose. They felt it. They might not like it. It might feel like something they'd like to get rid of. But a stressful day at work can include a level 5. The next question from that baseline of a tolerable coping level of anxiety is, now tell me when you first start to feel you've lost some kind of control, a thought, a feeling, physical. And the person will then very individually give their response to, oh, that's when I start texting all my friends. Oh, that's when I start looking forward to the drink at the end of the day. That's actually my tone of voice changes, and there's way too much aggression happening. So people
You're asking people to identify the beginning of when they've come out of what is normal stress to them to when they see anxiety. But the people I have loved in my life never can identify it at the beginning. It's always when they're lost, when they're up at the 7 and 8s, that it's obvious. And your tool is the following. No, let me teach you that if I could teach you to identify this at your 5s, when your 5 goes to 6.
Right.
So all of a sudden you have to pick up your computer and you got to search the internet. All of a sudden you've got to make those phone calls. All of a sudden you've got to do this. You gotta. And when you feel that happening, what you would say, Dr. Denning, is you would say, let's step this up a little. Let's make sure that whatever you're doing is not based on a growing level of anxiety, because these behaviors of texting all your friends, looking forward to the drink, making the phone calls, getting on your computer are not going to take away the anxiety. Is that true? I mean, wouldn't
That's
you just
exactly
exhaust
right.
yourself?
That's exactly right, because now if we can catch the anxiety in action, the person can ask the question of themselves, what is this anxiety about? What is happening now? You've heard me talk about historic development of an anxiety response, of our style of anxiety. This is the moment when our brain pulls that recipe into action so quickly, so quickly. The ability, the learning to catch the smaller signals, the shift between I'm coping, it's a hard day, I'm having to do all this effortful work, and oh, now I'm having to do this, I'm procrastinating, I'm not feeling well, I'm looking forward to the... What shift just happened? What just happened to me? Most people can feel that when they become resensitized to it. Then they can ask the question, what is the anxiety actually about?
Wow, if you got people to identify the 5 to the 6, you would have a tool for treating a whole bunch of things, which would include confused thinking, which would include eating too much or too little or disturbed sleep. You have to catch from the 5 to the 6. It's not seeing it when you're up at 9 and saying, I better take a tranquilizer.
Right.
Right? That's too late. It's going way back before then. Now, let me ask you a question of Linda. Linda, I know that part of the work you do is part of what you're doing in therapy is you have you teach people and work with yoga. In yoga, is there ever a time when you could identify anxiety specifically and that you have to do something to get past the anxiety?
By all means, Armand, yes. When we initially get into postures, we will do a very physical lifting of the shoulders, very classic example, of course, noting your breathing. Listening to your heartbeat. Those are all the preliminary of trying to get in touch with that feeling of anxiety, and then, of course, knowing better how we can address it. And I'll know the postures by seeing how a person, just by being able to lift their shoulders and rest them, seeing the eyebrows on the face and how we can either rest them or be not really able to rest them.
So now what you're talking about is you go beyond a thought process.
Yes.
Into a physical process, and you'll say, whatever is stopping you right now, go past it.
By all means,
let
yes.
yourself pursue this, because you're going to be able to get centered from this. You're going to be able to find your 5 again.
Yes.
if you catch it early. So the practice of yoga must be terrific for doing that.
By all means, it's really exemplary. It's a wonderful opportunity to get to that five, if not a little bit lower. Yes.
And to bring it even down from the five,
yes, by
so
all
that
means.
You have a little room.
Yes.
Okay, let's go back now. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
So Sarah, what are the questions that we would ask of people? Okay, when you were saying you were identifying the levels, what are the questions that you would ask?
Well, let's take it from a 5 to a 6 for a moment. Let's look at what might have been previously a level 4. Some kind of effort, some kind of tension, something that needs to be done, just needs to be done. It becomes a 5 because now it is either urgent, truly, or incorrectly. There's something called false urgency that pushes us around all the time. So if Linda, for example, can help someone learn to breathe or create a body posture that's going to stop their symptomology from escalating to a 6, what I also want people to do, because they're getting all those signals, is I want them to also, again, ask the what. This is the most important part. If I can know in some way what I am reacting to, what my style of reaction is, if I am angry, if I'm depressed, if I am frustrated, if I continue with that, I'm not going to get anywhere. If I just, quote, let it go, I'm never going to get to the causality. I try to teach people through the book, through seminars, exercises, find the causality. Now we have a much more permanent, not just in the moment, teaching ability, self-taught. So I'm not on the yoga floor, the yoga mat. I'm not meditating somewhere nicely. I'm not letting it go. I'm in it. What do I do while I'm in it?
Identifying it is such a difficult thing because we're not identifying a real thing. I mean, we're identifying somebody could make up all the time what causes this. You know, I went into my boyfriend's house and I found that there were some nuts on the table in his kitchen, and it made me very anxious because I thought maybe somebody else was there. Now, you could say, therefore, every time I'm suspicious of my boyfriend, I get anxious?
Yes, and then I would say,
or maybe the very fact that you were looking for nuts mm-hmm. means you walked in there with that anxiety.
I would say, let's take the boyfriend out of the equation.
And we leave the nuts?
And the nuts.
What kind of nuts? No nuts? Any nuts? Brazil nuts? I'm only kidding.
All nuts. Let's get all nuts out of the equation.
All nuts. Now, if you did, then we'd have no radio show.
And let's look at the suspicion.
Okay.
The suspicion here is the cue to the anxiety.
Good.
Now, I would then ask that person, and here we get very psychodynamic, very psychoanalytical. This pulls all of these together. This is not the new thing by itself. This is an accumulation of all of this good work that psychologists have done. We bring neurology in and we say, aha, suspicious. Where did this brain get to use suspicion before, interpersonally, experientially? I don't know if it's 2-year-old suspicion. I don't know if it's junior high school suspicion.
Give me an example of 2-year-old suspicion.
Well, you and I both know, and many listeners know as well, there's something called a pre-verbal experience. We don't have the words for it. And when I hear my patient saying, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, it just feels that way. We probably have a very early learned response on our hands because they really don't have that cognition of it.
A learned response of a sense of danger.
Yes.
That existed somewhere when you were maybe in your crib.
Maybe.
Without even knowing it.
Maybe.
I was once watching a child, somebody who had a memory flashback on them, and they were living in an apartment where it was very hot. They didn't have air conditioning, and she said she remembered being bitten by flies, by mosquitoes. This is a baby being bitten by mosquitoes in the summer, and she always had a tremendous negative reaction to open windows, but she never knew why. And everybody thought it had to do with suicide or something else, but when she finally caught it,
it made perfect sense. And this is what I find with my patients all the time. It makes perfect sense. And when it makes sense to the patient, they have a grounding that feels very, very different to work with. There is a worksheet called Original Fear, and it is amazing.
It's one of the worksheets in your book.
Yes.
In your workbook.
Yes.
Okay.
It's called Original Fear, and if we can actually find it, I have patients who were bullied in junior high school. You'd be amazed. I'm always amazed. When we start talking like this, It doesn't take them very long. I was 14 years old. I walked into the lunchroom. Everybody stared at me. That moment is in their brain. As we now know, and we've always known, but now we get this beautiful little neurological picture of it, we now see it in action right now. So original fear, can I catch it in the moment? Is there a way for me to come down from a 6 or not reach a level 6? Can I come down to a 5 and a 4? What is the anxiety about? This is a recipe. So all very important pieces.
If you get, I would imagine, if you were grading it, if you were looking at it, if you were doing a brain study or a galvanic and a GSR machine, what would happen is a person went from a current anxiety to a primal anxiety or an earlier anxiety. I would imagine it would intensify the closer to the truth it got.
Yes, exactly.
Right? And that's what you would see.
It's a primed response.
That's right.
And that's what our anxiety stress style of response
is based on. That's so different than behavioral modification, what you're doing there.
Yes, it is.
And that's, I think, where you have some real value in what you're offering. I mean, I think you have a lot of real value in what you're offering, just in your understanding.
Thank you.
But that specifically saying, and will include an understanding.
Yes, because people feel so differently when it, quote, makes sense.
Yeah.
They settle down. They can work with that safely. The anxiety around the anxiety is lower. So we actually can create what I call a pivotal moment. In the book that I wrote on teenage anxiety, I use the game of basketball. It is perfect. It's beautiful. I catch the ball. I have to stop for a few moments and reevaluate what's going on around me. It is literally called a pivot. And I look at my teammates. I feel where I am on the court. I look where is the basket. What do I do? Do I pass? Do I hold? Do I dribble? It's the same thing. What do I do now that I've caught it? And that's a whole set of tools, things that people actually do naturally at some point, once we understand what's happening. So that pivotal moment is now possible once we have that causality, and it makes sense.
And sometimes you can't identify it. Sometimes it takes someone like you or me being able to say to a person, from what you're telling me, your mom drank all the time and your father wasn't at home. You may have never felt safe.
Yes.
You're carrying this from way back then.
Yes.
But if a person is carrying such a heavy load from back then, can they be ever free of it now? Do you think by exposing and recognizing the stuff in the past, the person can be free of it by changing themselves?
I'll go along with not free, unfortunately. I always tell my patients this will always be there, but it's a glitch, and it's short-lived, and it's less intense.
And you get a short reaction. I had that happen the other day. I had a fast reaction to something, and I said, wait a minute, I'm having this reaction. I just don't trust myself.
That's it, right there.
Yeah.
You got it. Wait a minute.
Wait a minute. Don't react. Don't start making trouble over this one. You know, it has got to relate to something else all the way back when. And I worked on it. I was able to identify it. I was so grateful.
Yes, exactly.
Because it went away completely.
And you are well practiced in that process.
Yeah. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, a little music. And we'll continue with Dr. Sarah Denning and this incredible work that she's doing. Thank you. Be right back.
Thank you.
Street Boogie, Harry James, and his orchestra. We're speaking with Dr. Sarah Denning about anxiety. You want to know anxiety? Here's one for you. Here's the trick of the day. I would like you to write down the year you were born, just the last two numbers of the year you were born. Can you write that down? Write it down, the last two numbers, right? And then add to that your age today. And I'll bet you come up with the number 111. Did you do that? Did you get 111? Did you get 111? Isn't that tricky? How do you like that? 111.
What does it mean?
What does it mean? When you get the book on the anxiety notebook, you'll learn. No, I don't know what it means. I really don't. But everybody comes up with 111 when you add the year you were born into your current age. This year.
It's a good trick.
It's a nice trick. What?
It's what you're supposed to be this year.
It's what you're supposed to be, 111.
Yeah. No, if I would have put 23, it wouldn't have been 111. But I'm put 24, which is what I'll turn in September. And that's how it gets to 111.
Okay, so this is a story about not who you are, but what you're supposed to be.
Exactly.
All right, which is exactly what we're talking about today. My friends, we're talking about anxiety. Anxiety, you can laugh about it a little bit, but I will tell you, maladaptive behavioral responses to stressors can ruin your life. Ruin your life. And there are times that you are more susceptible than other times. We've learned to be able to identify when people are more under stress than we thought before. We're able to find that. We're able to find, through neuroimaging, what part of the brain will have this response. We used to think that you only had one way of doing it and that you were set in this way forever. Personality doesn't change. But Dr. Sarah Denning also proposes that we look at the work of neurogenesis. Neurogenesis sounds like a religious thing.
Or a rock band.
You know, neurogenesis.
Yeah.
It should be a rock
Both.
Band.
It's very spiritual. And
neurogenesis. But what is neurogenesis about?
Neurogenesis is fascinating in that we have dendrites. I love that word, too. Sounds dental, but it's not. We have neurological structures in our brain, in the hippocampus and the amygdala particularly, which look like trees. If you took a full image of a tree, the top, the roots, the whole bit, it's very funny looking because they look the same, kind of. They're almost mirror images. So they're called branches, actually, and it's called arborization. These are the terms used for the neurology. And when we are under severe either one-time severe stress, event-related, or, this is my favorite, chronic stress over periods of time, our dendrites, our little branches, shrink. Very dangerous. It's like a dehydrated brain, which if anybody's ever had a hangover, they know what a dehydrated brain feels like. It doesn't function very well, and it feels pretty bad. So we also have discovered, and this is some pioneering work done by Dr. Kendall, that dendrites not only shrink under stress, either kind of stress, or they regenerate neurogenesis. There it is. How do we regenerate this beautiful, flexible brain that we have?
Part of what we used to believe is that your brain cells die over cells. And what we found is that maybe you can't use the axon being the central part of the nerve, and the dendrites being the extremity, the part that reaches out to the other nerve cells. I kind of like thinking about it as fingers at the end of your hand.
Yeah, same thing.
You know, and then so my fingers reach your fingers, but after a while, through any number of things, my fingers withdraw, and I don't have my fingers available. Now, what we've noticed, and just recently, this is the last 2 years, they're talking about the neurogenesis, the rebuilding of these dendritic kind of things so that your brain can always grow.
Yes, and be flexible, and there's the key. Anxiety and fear close us down and make us rigid in many, many different ways. That's its job. That's what it's supposed to stop us from whatever it is that's going to happen to us.
But it would seem, Sarah, that if your dendrites are removed, if your nerve cells are withdrawn, you would have less of a transmission, therefore you would be less anxious. That's what I studied when I studied this. It would seem that if you, because there are some chemicals they give you that actually get you to withdraw. When people drink, they could withdraw, the dendrites withdraw, and you don't have that same kind of transmission. Mm-hmm. So you're less anxious at that point. So the problem seems to be in maladaptive transmission. Mm-hmm. The problem seems to be that when I am transmitting too rapidly, too often, too many times, that's where I start feeling panic. When I'm firing on all cylinders, when I only need to fire on three, that's where I run into trouble. So that would not necessarily precipitate neurogenesis. We would be saying we don't have to grow new nerve cells. We just have to isolate the nerve cells that we want functioning or pull back on the other nerve cells. Sometimes we just get too nervous.
Well, the overstimulation of those dendrites is the problem.
Right.
So indeed, anything, as we know, will burn out, get exhausted, and at some point withdraw or atrophy with too much use or too much juice or too much excitement. So indeed, that is really the process that we're seeing, is that these dendritic branches wither, they shrink up under too much stress because of too much stress. And what we now are able to see is that they will grow back. And our question now is, how do they get there in the first place? And how do we grow them back? And the answer seems to be through experience. That's how they got there. And the way we bring them back is through new, maybe corrective, maybe comforting, maybe learning experiences. And this is where, to some degree, exposure therapy has taught us that we can, again, regenerate this flexibility of this brain system that we have.
Well, good. You know, what I think you're saying, and I really appreciate it, that people can, you know, let's say you have somebody you're in love with and they're very under a lot of stress, as many people are nowadays. They're trying to work a job, they're trying to keep their family going, the stress. And you love somebody and you see them so stressed out that you're afraid. Now, I know one of the things that's wrong is that stress itself is not the evil, but strain is the evil. When the stress begins to break down
exactly.
In your body.
Exactly.
So if you see someone you care about going to this level of stress, what would you suggest that you do to approach the person to say to them, look, I know you're heavily under stress and there's nothing you could do about it. Instead of, can I fix you a drink? What's a better alternative?
Let's get physical. Let's get physical, which is our original stress comforting in our very early years. And we sometimes forget to simply breathe, touch, connect. And it doesn't have to be sexual and it doesn't have to be intimate. I'm sure that everybody has experienced having just someone put their hand on their shoulder. Wow, that's incredible medicine.
Well, one of the things I've also seen when I see people do that is people don't know how to put their hand on somebody's
yes.
shoulder. You know the mistake they make? They rub the person.
Yes, exactly, which
not
might
the time,
stimulate.
Right, not the time to stimulate them. What yes. you want to do is give them the solid feeling.
And you sure don't want to pat them either.
Right, you don't want to pat them. You don't want to stimulate.
No.
You mainly want to say, I'm here.
Right, and it is a continuous, gentle touch that actually helps our physical symptoms lower them. We're back to that beautiful breathing, temperature, heart rate. It's so simple. Linda Mays is doing some work up at the Yale Center in very, very young children and their caregivers. And she's teaching caregivers that, again, this very simple nonverbal hands-on is a tremendous change of stress. And we forget because it is so simple.
Yeah, and you know, it's so strange that the crazy fears that people have, that there are physicians who won't touch their patients without wearing gloves nowadays. So we've kind of, let's put a something between you and me even further. And boy, getting touched by a glove hand doesn't necessarily make you feel much more comfortable.
In fact, it might be frightening.
And it may be why people love to sleep together.
Of course.
You know, one of the beauties of holding somebody in your arm or having somebody sidle up against mm-hmm. your back is that all kind of goes away.
Yes.
Because you have it. So this is yes. great. Let's get physical, which
yes.
is a... which is one, and that could include, physical could also include whatever you could do to relieve your body, like exercise or yoga or any of those other things, if you don't have anybody to get physical with.
I'm smiling as you say that, because any of my patients who are listening will tell you immediately what I tell them in their first session, and that is, do you run? Do you swim? Do you walk? When are you outdoors? Do you do yoga? You have to do something like this every day. I'm not kidding. 20 minutes. Not aerobic. 20 minutes. Movement. Qigong. Tai Chi. Meditation. Meditation can be an exercise. If we do 10 minutes, we get up, we stretch. It is very much a physicality, this anxiety that we carry.
So why is this? Now, of course, everybody would say, oh, yeah. But why is it? Why is it that you have to move your body to feel less anxiety? Why is it? What is the actual physiology of that one? Because why can't you just do it like, you know, I'll give you a dozen people I know who sit and meditate for 24 hours and they're perfectly at peace. You know, I know priests and Buddhists who they never move.
Yes, I do too. And it's actually, I think, kind of an anomaly, to tell you the truth, because most people don't. Those people can, and they do. And that's marvelous. But the Buddhists who I know also walk and talk and eat and take baths. And by the way, they also play golf and play tennis and walk their dogs. So they just sit all the time. Now,
they call Frankfurter Buddhists.
Again.
It's called one with everything.
Yes. And neurologically, our entire system is built around standing and walking and moving in our environment. There's a beautiful amount of environmental, biological, historic psychology in our brains. We are not built to sit for very long. So literally, again, neurologically, our brain wants our body to move. It brings us relief.
So that's a piece of it. And you find that anxiety increases when people don't do that. So if you get people back in motion in some way, that's one thing. Now, let's say that we're trying to work through the scale for people. Now, I'm going to recommend that people, if they want to search this out further, they can go. There's a book called The Anxiety Workshop.
Notebook.
Anxiety Notebook.
My Anxiety Notebook.
Is it yours?
No, it's
that's
yours.
The name of the book.
Anybody who's working on it, it's your Anxiety,
anxiety Notebook. You were going through a survey of how people could identify a 1 to a 10, and you were saying from 5 to 6. What happens after 6?
After 6, as we were saying earlier, our bodies really take over, and we are out of control of our responses. We are sweating too much. Our voices are raised. Our shoulders are tight. We are acting out. That's a beautiful old term that's still a wonderful example of what happens to us. We begin to act out our anxiety. We drink too much. We have too much sex. We talk too much. We smoke too much. We withdraw. Here's another tricky part of anxiety. Sometimes withdrawal. And anxiety can be the precursor to depression. So we stop all of our activities. And so this is a funny
point.
How
does that work? That's a funny thing. You're
funny
right.
Point.
I'm glad as a psychologist you could identify that. That there is a point when, because of your anxiety, what you may do, probably, and I would imagine that the people who do it are people who have difficulty expressing anger. So what they do is they feel this agitation, they can't express their anger, they withdraw into their own thoughts. Now you're withdrawn and you're repressing it, and the only thing you could do is turn the anger against yourself. So you turn this anxiety by blaming yourself.
Blaming yourself or turning it off, which is impossible, so it's still there. We've just lowered the flame, so it's always burning. We have not really turned it off, and damage is being done. So blame yourself, yes, or decide that you're going to avoid, not act, not think about it. These are great problems that create ongoing stress, not actually resolving the stress. Now, there's another trick here that I think we should be interested in for the people who are listening to play around with today. Let's go from a 0 to a 1. Let's not just do a 5 to a 6. Let's play around this afternoon with life is pretty good. Things are okay. Uh-oh. Uh, Now I'm leaving that blank on purpose because I want people to fill that in. At a 1, not a 6. At a 2. At a 3. At a 4. What's happening? Oh, well, I just bit the inside of my mouth a little bit. Well, I just, you know, I went out and took a cigarette break. Oh, well, you know, I just started texting people that, you know, I don't really have any, you know, I should get back to my work. Do you hear? And you can even hear it in my voice as I'm playing around with these lower levels. This, we really want people to be resensitized. My patients always laugh at me. Yeah, resensitized to our lower levels. We go back to yoga. What is the balanced position? It feels lovely. It's a 1. I actually feel good here. This is really nice. There's a shift. I'm off balance. Oops! That's a 1. That's a 2.
So the sensitivity that a person can develop is where they begin to identify where they're moving away from their centered place or the place where they're calm, mm-hmm. to just a tiny bit of the nervousness, a little bit of the anxiety. And if you could grab it, if you don't have to bite it like a fish hook, you know, and continue with it, okay, you could identify it, you could back off from it. Most people, once they get started in that direction, it starts off with 1, then you get a reaction. You start texting and you get a text back that you didn't like or a response you didn't expect, right? And then that builds into something else, and that builds into somebody else, something else. And then you're at the, I gotta. It's that I gotta place where you, I gotta make this call, I gotta do this, I just gotta finish this research, I told my mother I would do this research for her, so I'm gonna do it now. And you get that thing going, and once that's going, it's very hard to back away.
Right, so resensitizing is very interesting as a practice.
What does that concept mean, resensitizing?
Well, again, we used to be more sensitive to things when we were very, very young. Again, our brains didn't have the same physicality that they have now. We're little sponges when we're very, very young. You know, a cookie can be awe-inspiring. The idea of going to the beach can be phenomenal. We're very sensitive. We're very sensitive when the cookie breaks. We break into tears very quickly. So resensitizing, hopefully not to that very almost naive level, but resensitizing to these shifts that take place so we can catch it sooner. It's not a catastrophe. I'm not out here with my full-blown panic attack by any means. I'm back here sitting in my office, sitting at home with the person that I'm with, and I'm experiencing my level of anxiety that I might be able to resolve.
You know, I had a good friend of mine who said he was audited by the IRS, and his wife was filing for divorce, and he had one of the other major stresses, and he lost his home all at the same time.
Wow.
And I said to him, I said, well, how are you getting through it? He said, well, they're just things. He said, I'll get through them. He says, I've gotten through everything else in life. He said, I'll get through them. And knowing that you could get through this stuff and just being able to tell yourself, just because it's the Internal Revenue Service, just because it's a divorce, just because I'm losing my house, I'm going to get by. That's an amazing thing. It's one of the advantages of age.
And it is the advantage of age of a person who is awake to their past experiences. The whole mix. Yes, things can be terrible. And yes, things can be okay. And yes, I will probably get through, and it might not be easy. But so we have a full mix and the appreciation of all of it, not just recognizing either, well, it'll be fine, or this is really terrible.
Sarah, I wish I had more time to explore this with you, because there's really some way that you use this in working with bipolar symptoms as
yes.
well. Can you give me just a quick minute on how you work with a manic depressive illness?
We just touched on it.
Or is it just we don't have the time for
No, you gave me a great setup. It is the mix. It is the mix of middle ground and a full multidimensional range of emotions and thoughts that I want my patients to recognize as a wonderful place to come back to most of the time when they feel they've gone too far in one direction or the other. And these people have a brain that is adapted, here we go again, to that switching back and forth, one or the other, black or white, crisis or success. And we have to, again, resensitize to this full mix this overlap, this duality of feelings that we can all have at the same time. So it's not just one feeling or another. It's multidimensional. This is what we begin to work on.
So if you have somebody who's bipolar, and let's say they don't necessarily experience the manic side of it, right? Even on the depressive side, you could find anxiety that you work with bipolarity, that you could help a person identify and rebalance.
Very much, because as we know, depression becomes an extreme. People use words like never, always, forever. And those are the verbal signs, very much, the thoughts of depression. If we can bring back the word maybe and sometimes, even that, let's get those words back in your mind, sometimes, maybe. Those are marvelous words to create that mix again. So there's lots of ways to work with our anxiety.
There are times when a person will feel hormonal changes that will leave them a little more predisposed to dealing with panic and anxiety or experiencing panic and anxiety than other times. Do you think that it behooves people? Behooves? Jesus, where did that come from?
Great word.
Right. Do you think it helps people to identify their own hormonal cycles so that they could be prepared for raises in anxiety, like around menopause and around menstrual cycles and around male changes and stuff like that?
Very much so. And again, we go back to the body, which is cyclical even within a 24-hour period. If we can be aware not just of our hormones, because we can't go around, you know, spitting into a test tube and measuring things all day long. We sure can feel them, though, with body temperature. We can feel them with the amount of sleep or tiredness that we are experiencing. So it is also that similar resensitizing to these lower levels, body fluctuations just within the day, let alone within the month or the week, that keeps our mind a little bit more aware these things are happening now.
Thank you so much. Dr. Sarah Denning, the founder of Adaptive Behavioral Therapy, the author of My Anxiety Notebook. Thank you very much for being with us, Sarah. We're going to have to pick up on this and go a little further, which I'd love to do with you.
Anytime. It was fun.
Great. Thank you. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. You can replay this program on WBAI.org. You can hear it in the archives there or in the archives at ThePositiveMind.com. Thank you all. Thank you, Lauren, for bringing this to us. And thank you, Linda.
And thank you, Armand DeMille. Mm-hmm.